Gold has weird value. Most important thing is bouncing or throwing the ball, or how one looks on a screen. And very often, it doesn't value the important things like character, and there's never any trophies for it. Usually not any medals or television shows for it, but it's evident to people like us that character matters most. And we have lots of verses in the Bible talking about women's characters. And we're going to look at three or four of them. Then I'll see how time permits. And I will be real nice during the Mother's Day sermon, but if I get to the Right to Life sermon, I'm going to be mad. That one's over here. So, Mother's Day sermon. You'll turn me to 1 Samuel 25. We're going to look at different examples of ladies in the Bible. This one here is Abigail, and her example is continuing despite mistreatment. Doing what is right, even though there is mistreatment. We should say endurance. Bible would say long-suffering. Sometimes patience, if, as long as it's patience against being mistreated. And the full story is longer than we can read, but we'll read 1 Samuel 25, verse 3. Now the man's name was Nabal. His wife's name was Abigail. And the woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. Well, we won't read about the whole story, but he's stingy and mean to David. So I actually, every once in a while, nobody in the church, there is counseling and there is violence in the home and it's dangerous. And then you'd say, well, you have to leave, make sure the violence is not there. This does not seem to be a situation of danger, but the guy, his name is Fool. I can't imagine his mother named him Nabal, which means fool, so he must have got that nickname later on in life. And as an adult, everybody called him Fool. There's his new name. And very stingy to David, and Abigail kind of puts up with it. Now, he later, I think he has a heart attack as the story goes on, and he's gone, but she was tolerating meanness. Again, I don't think danger, but meanness. The guy wasn't right. So she put up with the meanness. We're going to have examples of diligence without meanness. I would say that Simon Peter's wife was that way. Remember that Jesus healed his mother-in-law, therefore he must have been married. So Simon Peter was married. Now, as we go on in the missionary travels, he's all over the place doing ministry, and either the kids were grown and she went with him, or else she stayed home. So either way you do that, she was enduring a lot. So let's think about endurance, especially against wrong. I don't mean unsafe, but endurance, doing what is right, or endurance in hard work, and there'll be other examples of that. That kind of overlaps with courage, but I'd like to look at Moses' mother for courage, and that's the story in Exodus chapter 1. Abigail put up with harshness, and Moses' mother shows great courage, even in risking of her life. And the last verse of Exodus chapter 1 will give the times that they lived in, and then Exodus chapter 2 will give her courage against evil. Exodus 1:22, what a country. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born to you, you are to cast into the Nile. And every daughter you are to keep alive. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. Her name was actually Jochebed, but not given here. Verse 2, the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. When she could no longer hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set him along the reeds of the bank of the Nile. And then we know the rest of the story. This is baby Moses. His sister Miriam is watching. And the princess or Pharaoh's daughter comes and kind of is like a caretaker for the baby, although his mother does get to take more care of him. But our point is mothers show courage, even risk, to do what is right. It's amazing how bad this Egypt was at this time. God values life. We are supposed to obey the government, but the commands of the Bible are in order. Some are more important than others. And we don't obey the government when it says throw the boys in the river. And she took a great risk to hide the baby Moses and protect him. We could have used Esther. You'll remember Esther. That's another story of taking courage, taking a risk. The Jews at that time were put in a situation of genocide. The Persians had passed a law to kill them all on a certain day. Haman made that law. Mordecai, the relative, told her, you were born for such a time as this. I mean, you need to go. And she's taken a risk to go into the Persian emperor and to defend the Jews and to tell him that she was Jewish. So she took a risk of courage to do what is right against evil. Moses' mother and Esther. Another one that you'll probably know, but maybe not as famous, is Deborah in the book of Judges. Deborah was a prophetess. There are some. There were prophetesses in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians. In the Old Testament, Huldah is one of them. When Josiah rediscovered the law of Moses, they took his staff over there and talked with Huldah. Not as well known, I think we'll know her, but in Jerusalem, even now, the gates of the temple are called the Huldah Gates. And when Jesus was ministering on earth, that was the name of the gates of the temple, the Huldah Gates. Deborah was another prophetess. That means God would reveal to her what to do. Now, she wasn't in the military, except the way the story goes on in the book of Judges is the general, Barak, doesn't want to fight without her. So she ends up being a prophetess and a, shall we say, a co-general. God has delivered Sisera, the Canaanite general, into your hands, and he says, I will not go without you. And so she ends up being a general. Hopefully no one today, ladies today, need to fight a political war, but there was a Bible case of it where God talked to her and she was a prophetess. She also was a general fighting with him. So we have courage. We have Moses' mother, Jochebed, often not used. We have Esther, who will go in, risk her life, change the laws. We have Deborah. There's also other examples of that doesn't have the word courage, but it's kind of like Sarah. Can you imagine Abraham coming to Sarah and saying, God has talked to me, we're leaving this country, we're good on the camels, we're all going. So that would take a lot of courage, even though the Bible, I'm not sure, used that word courage, but it would have taken courage to get on the camels and obey God and go to a land they did not know. So we have endurance despite wrong, that would be Abigail. Then we have courage, we use Moses' mother, although there's a longer list. Now I'd like to look at unselfish love, and that's not so much a story, it's a command. Let's look at Titus chapter 2. Now we're going to pick up Paul's writing in Titus chapter 2 right in the middle of a verse. We're going to look at verses 4 and 5. And he talks about men, then he talks about older women, then he gets to verse 4 and he's got younger women. Titus 2, 4 and 5. But they may encourage the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sensible, pure, workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, so that the word of God will not be dishonored. Then he goes on with young men, not for today, but young women love their husbands, love their children. Now, nobody's going to argue against any teaching on love. Everybody agrees on love. So, all over the world, they would say a sermon on love and love your husband was wonderful. Although we do have to say in the Bible, love often means being unselfish. The Lord Jesus Christ is the greatest example of this. Top example, it did not feel good for him to die on the cross. Very often, love is defined as feelings, and yes and no. There's agape love, which is a commitment. There's phileo love, which is feelings. When possible, it's good to have both. Commitment to do what is right, whether it feels good or not. Good feelings whenever possible. But if not possible, a commitment, an agape love, to do what is right, whether it feels good or not. That's the Lord Jesus Christ. It didn't actually feel good when he died on the cross. Not real tender, but he was committed to do what is right for us. That's the definition of love. And when applied to mothers, especially, you got crying babies in the middle of the night, and you got to carry them around. I remember a time when we were both sick. Bill and I were both sick, so it was a child. We were carrying him around in the middle of the night. Unselfish work. Whatever the Bible equivalent is to bring the water to water the sheep. We don't do that, but there's lots of Bible examples of women being unselfish, and they're going to carry the water to take care of the sheep. Unselfishness, Genesis 18, Abraham has three visitors, and then Abraham summons Sarah, quickly prepare three measures of fine flour and bake cakes. Then more of the water, Genesis 24, Abraham sends a servant to look for a good wife, and he finds a good wife with Rebekah because they're at the well. Watering the sheep, whatever the equivalent of boredom and monotony of watering the sheep is. Same thing in Genesis 29. Jacob goes back to the old country and he finds Rebekah watering the sheep. And we were close to it in Exodus chapter 2. After Moses goes up, he has to leave Egypt and he goes by the well in Midian. And he sees the girls coming with Jethro's sheep, and he noticed one of them, we'd say Zipporah or Sapphirah, and hard work, not getting a lot of attention. Hard work in the sense of it has to be done, and it isn't really noticeable, but it's monotonous. But hard work, whatever the equivalent of watering the sheep, is the same as taking care of the kids. We could have used Ruth. She's eventually a mother, and the story of Ruth does go that way. She's eventually a mother, but when it starts, she is a widow. And says to her mother-in-law, wherever you go, I will go. Ruth 1:16, in a time of famine, she moves to Israel. And then we see hard, monotonous work. I will go glean in the field. 1/2 bushel of barley for a day's work. Well, that's enough to keep going, but it isn't exactly wealthy, but it's enough for them. But God's purpose was to get Boaz's notice, and he noticed all that hard and faithful work and care for mother-in-law, and so her hard, monotonous work got attention in the story. So there are some examples of enduring evil. There are other examples of just doing what is right, whether anybody pays attention or not, just doing the equivalent of watering the sheep, although we don't do that, but we do other monotonous work. So fighting against wrong, like Abigail putting up with the fool, and not dangerous, but a lot of mistreatment. We have courage, we use Moses' mother. Here we have love, which is unselfishness. I'd like to move now to wisdom. And with this, we'll go to Proverbs 19 and then Proverbs 31. I'm going to use two Proverbs on wisdom. Both of them relate to women. Let's look at Proverbs 19, verse 14. And you're going to recognize, I think, both of these Proverbs. But Proverbs 19, 14. House and wealth are inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. Now, someone who is married to someone who is good realizes this and agrees with it. This is right around the context of the opposite of a wise woman. And if you just look one verse up, would you look, we read verse 14, we look at one verse up, the second part of it. The contentions of a woman are a constant dripping. So, wise women are from the Lord. Just got through saying here in verse 13, constant dripping. Now, I wrote this pamphlet on depression. And I stopped with 19 causes of depression. 20 would have been better. Nice even number. But the 20th cause of depression is a noisy wife. And since the book on depression was going to ladies in prison, I figured I would leave that one out. But you have here at the close of verse 13, the unwise woman. Then you have in verse 14, a prudent wife is from the Lord. There are other things like this, but there she dwell in the corner of the roof over the contentious woman. That's Proverbs 21:9. You can also look at 21:19. Here we should stress gift. Psalm 121 is the children are a gift. And here a good wife is a gift. And the person with fair thinking and objective thinking realizes it. We're kind of in the middle in our country. There are good women. There are a lot of them that aren't any good. Maybe I'll get to the second sermon. Anyway, a prudent wife is from the Lord. Now, wisdom is also used in Proverbs 31. And we're just going to look at verse 26. Proverbs 31 obviously makes a really good Mother's Day sermon. So does the story of Ruth. So does the story of Esther. We have done all of these, so I decided just to put them in for various illustrations for today. Sometime we'll go back to them. But we go to Proverbs 31, verse 26. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. Sometimes I think the words wisdom and knowledge can go back and forth. Other times there, the Bible wants to distinguish them. If you distinguish them, knowledge is factually true. This is factually true, so on and so forth, factually true. Wisdom, though, kind of involves decisions, making a choice based upon what is factually true. Godly people want to know what is true and what is right, and they also want to know what is false and what is wrong. So that's knowing, but wisdom is making a choice. Here, the praise is for a woman who chooses what is right and then tries to converse on what is right. Teaching can be formal teaching. Our habit has been try to read to the kids till they were about 10, then I don't know what. And we've had that with the grandkids a few nights of the week to come, read to them. So that's the formal teaching, but there's a lot of teaching in a conversation. When some topic comes up, that's true, that's not true. Then there is teaching by example. So in the Bible, wisdom from the good type of wife and mother. In the other texts on teaching, often it's the men, Ephesians 6, bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, but women also. Here's Proverbs 6:20, my son, observe the commandment of your father, do not forsake the teaching of your mother. So even though there's a lot in the Bible of fathers teaching the children, there's Proverbs 6:20. I also have the example of Timothy. In the book of Acts, Timothy's mother was a believer. Father, it just says he was a Gentile, maybe not even a believer. But it says in 1 Timothy that he was brought up by his mother and grandmother, gives their names. Lois and Eunice, but just before that famous text on all scriptures inspired, you have verse 15, that from a child you have known salvation. So he was brought up by a mother and grandmother. We've looked at faithfulness when one is mistreated. That would be Abigail, 1 Samuel 25. Again, I would like to not say danger, but mistreatment, harshness, novel the fool, endurance. We have the courage to do what is right against the wrong. Moses' mother, Exodus 1 and 2. We could add Esther. We could add Deborah. We have a love commanded, Titus 2, unselfish love. And we have wisdom. Knowledge is knowing what is right. Wisdom is doing what is right. Now, when I'm making this sermon, I would every half hour or so go see the news, and I will try not to be mad. I'm not real happy, although good things are happening. And I would like to review a little bit. Don't worry, we'll get you out of here. But come with me to Exodus 21, please. If you want to go ahead and get ahead, we'll do Psalm 139 next. I'm going to review a little bit on the unborn. This was my master's thesis way back when in Washington, D.C. So we have already done for the last 40 years, we have all the Hebrew words and all the verses of the unborn in the Bible. And this will just be a little bit of a review. The phrase right to life is in the founding documents twice. One could argue, well, it doesn't concern the unborn, but there were no allowance of abortion at the time. So I think it's a better argument. Right to life is in it. But if it's not in it, then everything not in it, the Constitution gives to the states. That is just historically and politically accurate and has been the whole time. If it's in the Constitution, the right to life, then abortion should be outlawed. If it's not in it, it should go to the states. Just rational. Sorry. But whatever the government does, the Bible is kind of clear on it. And we will look quickly at Exodus 21. And I'm going to read verses 22 and following. Man struggle with each other and struck a woman with child, so she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury. He shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him. He shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, so forth. What you have here is what we would call manslaughter. It was not intended. In the first part, two guys are fighting, and a woman tries to intervene, and there is a premature birth. The premature birth, the baby is alive, even that was a penalty, a financial penalty. But if there was harm to either one, mother or child, there was the death penalty. What does that say about the Bible's view of the unborn? Accidentally killing them is the death penalty. Now, what about deliberate? It's not in there because it need not be in there. Thou shalt not kill was already given. So there's Exodus 21 correctly translated. If you really have an old version of the Bible, I don't mean King James was right, but if you have like an old New American Standard that was not right, and so down through the years, fix it, fix it, fix it, fix it. I just read New American Standard. They fixed it. So accidental abortion, even accidental in the law of Moses, was considered wrong. Now, Psalm 139 is meant to be positive. There wouldn't be anything about abortion in it. It's just meant to look at unborn babies and how great they are, and it ought to look at the intelligence of God. So if you look at Psalm 139, and verse 13 through 16. For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. For I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret, skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. Well, that wasn't meant to be a sermon on abortion. That's just about unborn babies. And unborn babies are the work of God. Now, it's obvious that God doesn't prevent taking some of them to heaven. He didn't stop them at all. But unborn babies are a work of God. And destroying them is to oppose God's work. That's very simple. And when it says woven, that was used in the tabernacle and the weaving of the curtains. It was used of the priestly garments. We could say God is greatly involved. And to oppose his work, opposing his work. Verse 13 is kind of the oddest one. You form my inward parts, and you possessed me 83 times. I don't know why they say you. I think probably you form my inward parts, part A is like part B, and they just went along with it. Verse 13 says, you owned me. 83 times that word is used elsewhere. You owned me when I was inside of my mother. So who owns the unborn? God owns the unborn. Not the government, not even the parents directly. God owns the unborn. We won't go to Job 10, 8 through 12, but if you want to some other time, do that. It begins with, "You fashioned me." And that is the Hebrew word for pain, which is really odd, but you took great pains. You took great pains in the development of me when I was unborn. So we've done Exodus 21, we've done Psalm 139, and talked about Job 10, and we will close with Psalm 51. And David is talking, and he really feels guilty over the sin of Bathsheba and wants to confess, but he adds Psalm 51, verse 5. "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me." Well, in sin my mother conceived me. Where does a person's soul come from? The human body obviously comes from mom and dad. DNA passed on. Where does the soul come from? There are two choices, and one of them I don't think is very good. It would be that God creates souls every day. Beings every day create souls. But he's all done with creation. It was done on day six, so it's kind of odd that you'd say God creates human souls every day by the millions. Well, see, you have this sin nature, which is being referenced here. Is it good to view that God creates all these souls and he's done with creation, and he is the one that puts the sin nature in? That's really not a very good conclusion, that God infuses the sin nature. A better that the immaterial part of people comes from mom and dad, including the sin nature. So mom and dad help make the body of the baby, but mom and dad help pass on the immaterial nature, including the sin nature, but then, the soul starts at conception. One could argue that the soul grows, isn't completely there on day one, like the body grows, and, okay, I don't know. Usually the Catholic view is it's fully there, and maybe not be fully there, but isn't very long, and it is a human nature from the beginning. I will end up stopping, but I used to go to the House and the Senate and watch the debates on abortion when I lived there. And I remember one of them was a senator from North Carolina talking with a professor from Harvard. "You mean to tell me we can go to the moon and go to the bottom of the earth, and you can't tell me that that is an unborn baby?" Didn't see that on the news at night. Bawling right out. Well, what else is it? Would it be a carrot? Anyway, we'll see where it goes. The Bible's teaching on the value of the unborn is rather clear. Relative to the laws of it, it's either in the Constitution, which it has the phrase right to life, but if you say it's not in the Constitution, then anything on the Constitution is for the states to decide. One is a political conclusion. The moral conclusion is the unborn are valued by God. Killing the unborn is opposing God. Well, a shorter Mother's Day sermon than the other. Would the musicians please come?